pithy and substantive, maybe with a little alliteration. But instead, I have one that's merely short. Yes. The chief deficiency of this answer, aside from its lack of pith, is that it is manifestly untrue, or at least misleading. The real answer, of course, is that no one knows for certain. Oh, for this writer or that one, we can be pretty sure, depending on what they themselves tell us, but in general, we make guesses. Let's look at the easy ones. James Joyce, T.S. Eliot, and what we could call the intentionalists. Writers who attempt to control every facet of their creative output and who intend virtually every effect in their works. Many of them are from the modernist period, essentially the era around the two world wars of the 20th century. In an essay called Ulysses, Order and Myth, 1923, Eliot extols the virtues of Joyce's newly published masterpiece and proclaims that whereas writers of previous generations relied on the narrative method, modern writers can, following Joyce's example, employ the mythic method. Ulysses, as we know from our earlier discussion, is the very long story of a single day in Dublin, June 16, 1904, its structure modeled on Homer's Odyssey, Ulysses being the Latin equivalent of the name of Homer's hero, Odysseus. The structure of the novel utilizes the various episodes of the ancient epic, although, ironically, Odysseus's trip to the underworld, for instance, becomes a trip to the cemetery. His encounter with Circe, an enchantress who turns men into swine, becomes a trip to a notorious brothel by the protagonists. Eliot uses his essay on Joyce to defend implicitly his own masterpiece, The Wasteland, which also builds around ancient myths, in this case, fertility myths associated with the Fisher King. Ezra Pound borrows from Greek, Latin, Chinese, English, Italian, and French poetic traditions in the Cantos. D.H. Lawrence writes essays about Egyptian and Mexican myth, Freudian psychoanalysis, issues in the Book of Revelation, and the history of the novel in Europe and America. Do we really believe that novels or poems by any of these writers or their contemporaries, Virginia Woolf, Catherine Mansfield, Ernest Hemingway, and William Faulkner, will be naive? Doesn't seem likely, does it? Faulkner, for instance, in Absalom, Absalom, 1936, makes use of a title from the Bible. Absalom is David's rebellious son who hangs himself, and plot and characters from Greek mythology. The novel is Faulkner's version of Aeschylus's Oresteia, 458 BC, the tragedy of the returning soldiers from Troy and revenge and destruction on a mythic scale. Their Trojan War is the Civil War, of course, and the murder at the gates is of the illegitimate son by his brother, not of the returning husband, Agamemnon, by his faithless wife, Clytemnestra, although she is invoked in the mulatto slave, Clytie. He gives us Orestes, the avenging son pursued by Furies and ultimately consumed in the flames of the family mansion, in Henry Sutpin, and Electra, the daughter consumed by grief and mourning, in his sister, Judith. Such Baroque planning and complex execution don't leave much room for naive, spontaneous composition. Okay, so much for the modern writers. But what about earlier periods? Prior to 1900, most poets would have received at least rudimentary elements of a classical education. Latin, some Greek, lots of classical poetry, and Dante and Shakespeare, certainly more than your average reader today. They could count on their readers, moreover, having considerable training in the tradition. One of the surest ways to be successful in theater in the 19th century was to take a touring Shakespeare company through the American West. If folks in their little houses on the prairie could quote the bard, is it likely that their writers accidentally wrote stories that paralleled his? Since proof is nearly impossible, discussions of the writer's intentions are not especially profitable. Instead, let's restrict ourselves to what he did do, and more important, what we readers can discover in his work. What we have to work with is hints and allegations, really evidence, sometimes only a trace, that points to something lying behind the text. It's useful to keep in mind that any aspiring writer is probably also a hungry, aggressive reader as well, and will have absorbed a tremendous amount of literary history and literary culture. By the time she writes her books, she has access to that tradition in ways that need not be conscious. Nevertheless, whatever parts have infiltrated her consciousness are always available to her. Something else that we should bear in mind has to do with speed of composition. The few pages of this chapter have taken you a few minutes to read. They have taken me, I'm sorry to say, days and days to write. No, I haven't been sitting at my computer the whole time. First, I carried the germ around for a while, mulling over how best to approach it. Then I sat down and knocked a few items onto the screen. Then I began fleshing out the argument. Then I got stuck. So I made lunch, or baked some bread, or helped my kid work on his car, but I carried the problem of this chapter around with me the whole time. I sat down at the keyboard again, and started in again, but got distracted and worked on something else. Eventually, I got where we are now. Even assuming equal levels of knowledge about the subject, who probably has had the most ideas? You in 5 minutes of reading, or me in 5 days of stumbling around? All I'm really saying is that we readers sometimes forget how long literary composition can take and how very much lateral thinking can go on in that amount of time. And lateral thinking is what we're really discussing. The way writers can keep their eye on the target, whether it be the plot of the play or the ending of the novel or the argument of the poem, and at the same time bring in a great deal of at least tangentially related material. I used to think it was this great gift literary geniuses have, but I'm not so sure anymore. I sometimes teach a creative writing course, and my aspiring fiction writers frequently bring in biblical parallels, classical or Shakespearean allusions, bits of R.E.M. songs, fairy tale fragments, anything you can think of. And neither they nor I would claim that anybody in that room is a genius. It's something that starts happening when a reader slash writer and a sheet of paper get locked in a room together. And it's a great deal of what makes reading the work of my students, of recent graduates of the Iowa Writers Workshop, of Keats and Shelley, interesting and fun. Chapter 11. More Than It's Gonna Hurt You. Concerning Violence. Consider. Sethi is an escaped slave, and her children were all born in slave-owning Kentucky. Their escape to Ohio is like the Israelites' escape from Egypt in Exodus. Except that this time, Pharaoh shows up on the doorstep threatening to drag them back across the Red Sea. So Sethi decides to save her children from slavery by killing them, succeeding with only one of them. Later, when that murdered child, the title character of Toni Morrison's Beloved, makes her ghostly return, she's more than simply the child lost to violence, sacrificed to the revulsion of the escaped slave toward her former state. Instead, she is one of, in the words of the epigraph to the novel, the 60 million and more Africans and African-descended slaves who died in captivity and forced marches on the continent or in the Middle Passage, or on the plantations made possible by their captive labor, or in attempts to escape a system that should have been unthinkable as, for instance, a mother seeing no other means of rescuing her child except infanticide. Beloved is, in fact, representative of the horrors to which a whole race was subjected. Violence is one of the most personal and even intimate acts between human beings, but it can also be cultural and societal in its implications. It can be symbolic, thematic, biblical, Shakespearean, romantic, allegorical, transcendent. Violence in real life just is. If someone punches you in the nose in a supermarket parking lot, it's simply aggression. It doesn't contain meaning beyond the act itself. Violence in literature, though, while it is literal, is usually also something else. That same punch in the nose may be a metaphor. Robert Frost has a poem, Out, Out, 1916, about a momentary lapse of attention and the terrible act of violence that ensues. A farm boy, working with the buzzsaw, looks up at the call to dinner, and the saw, which has been full of menace as it snarls and rattles along, seizes the moment, as if it has a mind of its own, to take off the boy's hand. Now, the first thing we have to acknowledge about this masterpiece is that it is absolutely real. Only a person who has been around the ceaseless danger of farm machinery could have written the poem, with all its careful attention to the details of the way death lurks in everyday tasks. If that's all we get from the poem, fine. The poem will in one sense have done its job. Yet Frost is insisting on more in the poem than a cautionary tale of child labor and power tools. The literal violence encodes a broader point about the essentially hostile or at least uncaring relationship we have with the universe. Our lives and deaths, the boy dies of blood loss and shock, are as nothing to the universe, of which the best that can be said is that it is indifferent, though it may be actively interested in our demise. The title of the poem is taken from Macbeth, Out, Out, Brief Candle, suggesting the brevity, not merely of a teenager's life, but of any human existence, particularly in cosmic terms. The smallness and fragility of our lives is met with the cold indifference not only of the distant stars and planets, which we can rightly think of as virtually eternal in contrast to ourselves, but of the more immediate outer world of the farm itself, of the inhumanity of machinery which wounds or kills indiscriminately. This is not John Milton's Lycidas, 1637. Not a classical elegy in which all nature weeps. This nature shows not the slightest ripple of interest. Frost uses the violence here, then, to emphasize our status as orphans, parentless, frightened, and alone as we face our mortality in a cold and silent universe. Violence is everywhere in literature. Anna Karenina throws herself under the train. Emma Bovary solves her problem with poison. D.H. Lawrence's characters are always engaging in physical violence toward one another. Joyce's Stephen Dedalus is beaten by soldiers. Faulkner's Colonel Sartoris becomes a greater local legend when he guns down two carpetbaggers in the streets of Jefferson. And Wile E. Coyote holds up his little yikes sign before he plunges into the void as his latest gambit to catch the Roadrunner fails. Even writers as noted for the absence of action as Virginia Woolf and Anton Chekhov routinely resort to killing off characters. For all these deaths and maimings to amount to something deeper than the violence of the Roadrunner cartoon, the violence has to have some meaning beyond mere mayhem. Let's think about two categories of violence in literature. The specific injury that authors cause characters to visit on one another or on themselves, and the narrative violence that causes characters harm in general. The first would include the usual range of behavior. Shootings, stabbings, garrottings, drownings, poisonings, bludgeonings, bombings, hit-and-run accidents, starvations, you name it. By the second, authorial violence, I mean the death and suffering authors introduce into their work in the interest of plot advancement or thematic development, and for which they, not their characters, are responsible. Frost's buzzsaw accident would be such an example, as would Little Nell on her deathbed in Dickens' The Old Curiosity Shop, 1841, and the death of Mrs. Ramsey in Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse, 1927. Is it fair to compare them? I mean, do death by consumption or heart disease really fall into the same universe as a stabbing? Sure. Different, but the same. Different, no guilty party exists in the narrative, unless you count the author, who is present everywhere and nowhere. Same, does it really matter to the dead person? Or this, writers kill off characters for the same set of reasons, make action happen, cause plot complications, end plot complications, put other characters under stress. And that's not enough reason for violence to exist? With some exceptions, the most prominent being mystery novels. Figure at least three corpses for a 200-page mystery, sometimes many more. How significant do these deaths feel? Very nearly meaningless. In fact, aside from the necessities of plot, we scarcely notice the deaths in a detective novel. The author goes out of her way, more often than not, to make the victim sufficiently unpleasant that we scarcely regret his passing, and we may even feel a sort of relief. Now, the rest of the novel will be devoted to solving this murder, so clearly it is important on some level. But the death lacks gravitas. There's no weight, no resonance, no sense of something larger at work. What mysteries generally have in common is a lack of density. What they offer in terms of emotional satisfaction, the problem solved, the question answered, the guilty punished, the victim avenged, they lack in weightiness. And I say this as a person who generally loves the genre and who has read hundreds of mysteries. So where does this alleged weight come from? Not alleged, felt. We sense greater weight or depth in works when there is something happening beyond the surface. In mysteries, whatever layering there may be elsewhere, the murders live on the narrative surface. It's in the nature of the genre that since the act itself is buried under layers of misdirection and obfuscation, it cannot support layers of meaning or signification. On the other hand, literary fiction and drama and poetry are chiefly about those other layers. In that fictive universe, violence is symbolic action. If we only understand Beloved on the surface level, Sethi's act of killing her daughter becomes so repugnant that sympathy for her is nearly impossible. If we lived next to her, for instance, one of us would have to move. But her action carries symbolic significance. We understand it not only as the literal action of a single, momentarily deranged woman, but as an action that speaks for the experience of a race at a certain horrific moment in history, as a gesture explained by whip scars on her back that take the form of a tree, as the product of the sort of terrible choice that only characters in our great mythic stories, a Jocasta, a Dido, a Medea, are driven to make. Sethi isn't a mere woman next door, but a mythic creature, one of the great tragic heroines. I suggested earlier that Lawrence's characters manage to commit a phenomenal amount of violence toward each other. Here are just a couple of examples. In Women in Love, Gudrun Brangwen and Gerald Crick meet after each of them has made separate displays of violent will. In front of the Brangwen sisters, Gerald holds a terrified mare at a grade crossing, spurring her until her flanks bleed. Ursula is outraged and indignant, but Gudrun is so caught up in this display of masculine power, and the language Lawrence uses is very much that of a rape, that she swoons. He later sees her engaging in eurythmics, a pre-Great War version of disco, in front of some highly dangerous Highland cattle. When Gerald stops her to explain the peril she has created for herself, she slaps him hard. This is, mind, their very first meeting. So he says, more or less, "I see you've struck the first blow." Her response? "And I shall strike the last." Very tender. Their relationship pretty much follows from that initial note, with violent clashes of will and ego, violent sex, needy and pathetic visitations, and eventually, hatred and resentment. Technically, I suppose, she's right, since she does strike the last blow. The last time we see them, though, her eyes are bulging out as he strangles her until suddenly he stops, overcome by revulsion, and skis off to his own death in the highest reaches of the Alps. Too weird? Want the other example? In his exquisite novella, The Fox, Lawrence creates one of the oddest triangles in literature. Banford and March are two women running a farm, and the only reason their relationship stops short of being openly lesbian must be because of censorship concerns, Lawrence already having had quite enough works banned by that time. Into this curious menage, a young soldier, Henry Grenfell, wanders, and as he works on the farm, a relationship develops between him and March. When the difficulties of a three-way set of competing interests become insurmountable, Henry chops down a tree which twists, falls, and crushes poor, difficult Banford. Problem solved. Of course, the death gives rise to issues which could scuttle the newly freed relationship, but who can worry about such details? Lawrence, being Lawrence, uses these violent episodes in heavily symbolic ways. His clashes between Gerald and Gudrun, for instance, have as much to do with deficiencies in the capitalist social system and modern values as with personality shortcomings of the participants. Gerald is both an individual and someone corrupted by the values of industry. Lawrence identifies him as a captain of industry, while Gudrun loses much of her initial humanism through association with the corrupt sort of modern artists. And the murder by tree in The Fox isn't about interpersonal hostility, although that antipathy is present in the story. Rather, Banford's demise figures the sexual tensions and gender role confusion of modern society as Lawrence sees it, a world in which the essential qualities of men and women have been lost in the demands of technology and the excessive emphasis on intellect over instinct. We know that these tensions exist, because while Banford, Jill, and March, Ellen or Nellie, sometimes call each other by their Christian names, the text insists on their surnames without using Miss, thereby emphasizing their masculine tendencies, while Henry is simply Henry or the young man. Only by radically changing the interpersonal sexual dynamic can something like Laurentian order be restored. There is also the mythic dimension of this violence. Gerald in Women in Love is repeatedly described as a young god, tall and fair and beautiful, while Gudrun is named for a minor Norse goddess. Their clash, then, automatically follows mythic patterns. Similarly, the young soldier comes striding onto the makeshift farm as a fertility god, fairly screaming virility. Lawrence shared with many of his contemporaries a fascination with ancient myths, particularly those of the wasteland and various fertility cults. For fertility to be restored to the little wasteland of the failing farm, the potent male and the fertile female must be paired off, and any blocking element, including any females with competing romantic interests, must be sacrificed. William Faulkner's violence emanates from a slightly different wellspring, yet the results are not entirely different. I know of creative writing teachers who feel Faulkner is the single greatest danger to budding fiction writers. So alluring is his penchant for violence that the imitation Faulknerian story will have a rape, three cases of incest, a stabbing, two shootings, and a suicide by drowning, all in 2,000 words. And indeed, there is a great deal of violence of all sorts in his fictional Yaknapatawpha County. In the story Barn Burning, 1939, young Sarty Snopes watches as his father, a serial arsonist, hires out to a wealthy plantation owner, Major Despain, only to attempt to burn the major's barn in a fit of class resentment. When Sarty, whose full name is Colonel Sartorius Snopes, attempts to intercede, Major Despain rides down Ab, the father, and Sarty's elder brother, and the last we hear of them is a series of shots from the major's pistol, leaving Sarty sobbing in the dust. The arson and the shootings here are, of course, literal and need to be understood in that light before we go looking for any further significance. But with Faulkner, the violence is also historically conditioned. Class warfare, racism, and the inheritance of slavery. At one point, Ab says that slave sweat must not have made the Despain mansion white enough and that therefore white sweat, his, is evidently called for. Impotent rage at having lost the Civil War all figure in the violence of a Faulkner story. In Go Down Moses, 1942, Ike McCaslin discovers while reading through plantation ledgers that his grandfather had sired a daughter by one of his slaves, Eunice, and then, not scrupling at incest or recognizing the humanity in his slaves that would make his act incest, got that daughter, Thomasina, pregnant. Eunice's response was to kill herself. That act is personal and literal, but it is also a powerful metaphor of the horrors of slavery and the outcomes when people's capacities for self-determination is stripped away utterly. The slave woman has no say in how her body or her daughter's has been used, nor is any avenue open for her to express her outrage. The only escape permitted to her is death. Slavery allows its victims no decision-making power over any aspect of their lives, including the decision to live. The lone exception, the only power they have, is that they may choose to die. And so she does. Even then, old Carruthers McCaslin's only comment is to ask whoever heard of a black person drowning herself, clearly astonished that such a response is possible in a slave. That Eunice's suicide takes place in a novel that draws its title from a spiritual, in which Moses is asked to go down into Egypt to set my people free, is no accident. If Moses should fail to appear, it may fall to the captive race to take what actions they can to liberate themselves. Faulknerian violence quite often expresses such historical conditions at the same time that it draws on mythic or biblical parallels. Not for nothing does he call one novel Absalom, Absalom, in which a rebellious, difficult son repudiates his birthright and destroys himself. Light in August, 1932, features a character named Joe Christmas, who suffers emasculation at the novel's end. While neither his behavior nor his particular wound is very obviously Christ-like, his life and death have to do with the possibility of redemption. Of course, things change when irony comes in, but that's another matter. Thus far, we've been speaking of character-on-character violence. So what about violence without agency, where writers simply dispose of their characters? Well, it depends. Accidents do happen in real life, of course. So do illnesses. But when they happen in literature, they're not really accidents. They're accidents only on the inside of the novel. On the outside, they're planned, plotted, and executed by somebody with malice aforethought. And we know who that somebody is. I can think of two novels from the 1980s that involve characters floating down to Earth after a jetliner explosion. Faye Weldon in The Hearts and Lives of Men, 1988, and Salman Rushdie in The Satanic Verses may have slightly different purposes in introducing such massive violence into their storylines and then having some characters survive. We can be fairly sure, however, that they do mean something, several somethings, by the graceful falls to earth that their characters undergo. The little girl in Weldon's novel occupies what amounts to a state of grace in an otherwise corrupt adult world. The easy descent of the airliner's tail section proves a lovely, gentle corollary to this quality in the child. Rushdie's two characters, on the other hand, experience their descent as a fall, not from innocence to experience, but from an already corrupt life into an existence as demons. So too with illness. We'll talk later about what heart disease means in a story, or tuberculosis, or cancer, or AIDS. The question always is, what does misfortune really tell us? It's nearly impossible to generalize about the meanings of violence, except that there are generally more than one, and its range of possibilities is far larger than with something like rain or snow. Authors rarely introduce violence straightforwardly to perform only its one appointed task, so we ask questions. What does this type of misfortune represent thematically? What famous or mythic death does this one resemble? Why this sort of violence and not some other? The answers may have to do with psychological dilemmas, with spiritual crises, with historical or social or political concerns. Almost never, though, are they cut and paste, but they do exist. And if you put your mind to it, you can usually come up with some possibilities. Violence is everywhere in literature. We'd lose most of Shakespeare without it, and Homer, and Ovid, and Marlowe, both Christopher and Philip, much of Milton, Lawrence, Twain, Dickens, Frost, Tolkien, Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Saul Bellow, and on and on. I guess Jane Austen wouldn't be too much affected, but relying on her would leave our reading a little thin. It seems then that there's no option for us but to accept it and figure out what it means. Chapter 12. Is that a symbol? Sure it is. That's one of the most common questions in class, and that's the answer I generally give. Is that a symbol? Sure. Why not? It's the next question where things get hairy. What does it mean? What does it stand for? When someone asks about meaning, I usually come back with something clever like, well, what do you think? Everyone thinks I'm either being a wise guy or ducking responsibility, but neither is the case. Seriously, what do you think it stands for? Because that's probably what it does, at least for you. Here's the problem with symbols. People expect them to mean something. Not just any something, but one something in particular. Exactly, maximum. You know what? It doesn't work like that. Oh, sure, there are some symbols that work straightforwardly. A white flag means, I give up, don't shoot. Or it means, we come in peace. See, even in a fairly clear-cut case, we can't pin down a single meaning, although they're pretty close. So some symbols do have a relatively limited range of meanings, but in general, a symbol can't be reduced to standing for only one thing. If they can, it's not symbolism. It's allegory. Here's how allegory works. Things stand for other things on a one-for-one basis. Back in 1678, John Bunyan wrote an allegory called The Pilgrim's Progress. In it, the main character, Christian, is trying to journey to the celestial city, while along the way, he encounters such distractions as the Slough of Despond, the Primrose Path, Vanity Fair, and the Valley of the Shadow of Death. Other characters have names like Faithful, Evangelist, and the Giant Despair. Their names indicate their qualities, and in the case of Despair, his size as well. Allegories have one mission to accomplish. Convey a certain message, in this case the quest of the devout Christian to reach heaven. If there is ambiguity or a lack of clarity regarding that one-to-one correspondence between the emblem, the figurative construct, and the thing it represents, then the allegory fails because the message is blurred. Such simplicity of purpose has its advantages. George Orwell's Animal Farm, 1945, is popular among many readers precisely because it's relatively easy to figure out what it all means. Orwell is desperate for us to get the point, not a point. Revolutions inevitably fail, he tells us, because those who come to power are corrupted by it and reject the values and principles they initially embraced. Symbols, though, generally don't work so neatly. The thing referred to is likely not reducible to a single statement, but will more probably involve a range of possible meanings and interpretations. Consider the problem of the cave. In his masterful novel, A Passage to India, 1924, E.M. Forster has as his central incident a possible assault in a cave. All through the first half of the work, the Maribor Caves hover over the story. They keep being referred to. They're out there, remarkable in some ill-defined way, mysterious. Our independent and progressive heroine, Adela Quested, does that name strike you as symbolic at all? Wishes to see them. So Dr. Aziz, an educated Indian physician, arranges an outing. The caves turn out to be not quite as advertised. Isolated in a barren wasteland, unadorned, strange, uncanny. Mrs. Moore, Adela's mother-in-law-to-be, has a very nasty experience in the first of the caves, when she suddenly feels oppressively crowded and physically threatened by the others who have joined her. Adela notices that all sound is reduced to a hollow, booming noise, so that a voice or a footfall or the striking of a match results in this booming negation. Mrs. Moore, understandably, has had enough of caves, so Adela does a bit of poking around on her own. In one of the caves, she suddenly becomes alarmed, believing that, well, something is going on. When next we see her, she has fled the scene, running and falling down the hillside to collapse into the arms of the racist English community she so vehemently criticized before. Badly bruised and scraped and poked by cactus spines, she is in shock and utterly convinced that she was assaulted in the cave and that Aziz must have been her assailant. Was that cave symbolic? You bet. Of what? That, I fear, is another matter. We want it to mean something, don't we? More than that, We want it to mean something, one thing for all of us and for all time. That would be easy, convenient, manageable for us. But that handiness would result in a net loss. The novel would cease to be what it is, a network of meanings and significations that permits a nearly limitless range of possible interpretations. The meaning of the cave isn't lying on the surface of the novel. Rather, it waits somewhere deeper. And part of what it requires of us is to bring something of ourselves to the encounter. If we want to figure out what a symbol might mean, we have to use a variety of tools on it. Questions, experience, pre-existing knowledge. What else is Forster doing with caves? What are other outcomes in the text, or uses of caves in general that we can recall? What else can we bring to bear on this cave that might yield up meaning? So, here we go. Caves in general. First, consider our past. Our earliest ancestors, or those who had weather issues, lived in caves. Some of them left us some pretty nifty drawings, while others left behind piles of bones and spots charred from that great discovery, fire. But the point here might be, no guarantees of course, that the cave on some level suggests a connection to the most basic and primitive elements in our natures. At the far end of the spectrum, we might be reminded of Plato, who in the Parable of the Cave section of the Republic, 5th century BC, gives us an image of the cave as consciousness and perception. Each of these predecessors might provide possible meanings for our situation. The security and shelter suggested by some Neolithic memory of caves probably won't work here, but something along the lines of Plato's cave interior may. Perhaps this cave experience has something to do with Adela getting in touch with the deepest levels of her consciousness, and perhaps being frightened by what she finds there. Now, Forster's use of the caves. The locals cannot explain or describe the caves. Aziz, a grand promoter of them, must finally admit he knows nothing of them, having never visited the site, while Professor Godbal, who has seen them, describes their effect only in terms of what does not cause it. To each of the characters' questions, are they picturesque? Are they historically significant? He offers a cryptic no. To his Western audience and even to Aziz, this set of responses is not helpful. Godbal's message might be that the caves must be experienced before they can be understood, or that every person's caves are different. Such a position might be borne out by the example of Mrs. Moore's unpleasant encounter in a different cave. Throughout the early portions of the novel, she has been impatient with other people and resentful of having them, their views, their assumptions, their physical presence, forced on her. One of the ironies of her Indian experience is that in a landscape so vast, the psychological space is so small. She came all this way and can't get away from life, England, people, death closing in on her. When she gets inside the cave, a crush of people threatens her. The jostling and brushing seem overtly hostile in their dark enclosure. Something unidentified but unpleasant. She can't tell if it belongs to a bat or an infant, but it's organic and not nice, rubs across her mouth. Her heartbeat becomes oppressive and she can't breathe, so she flees the cave as quickly as she can and takes a good while to calm down. In her case, the cave seems to force her into contact with her deepest personal fears and anxieties, other people, ungovernable sensations, children, and fecundity. There is also the suggestion that India itself threatens her, since all the people aside from Adela and herself in the cave are Indians. While she has tried to be Indian, to be comfortable and understanding of the natives in ways other members of the ruling British have not been, she can hardly be said to have mastered the Indian experience. So it may be that what she runs into in the darkness is the fraudulence of her attempt to be Indian. On the other hand, maybe she doesn't have an encounter with something at all. Perhaps what she meets in the cave is instead nothingness, albeit some years before Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, and the existentialists of the 1950s and 1960s articulate the dichotomy between, in Sartre's terms, being and nothingness. Could it be that what she finds in the cave isn't death necessarily, but the experience of the void? I think it quite possible, if by no means certain. So what does Adela's cave stand for? She has, or seems to have, all of the responses that Mrs. Moore does, although hers are different. As a virgin on the edge of spinsterhood who has been shipped halfway around the world to marry a man she doesn't love, she has some very understandable anxieties about matrimony and sex. In fact, her last conversation before entering the cave is with Aziz regarding his own married life, and her questions are probing and even inappropriate. Perhaps this conversation brings on her hallucination, if that is what it is, or perhaps it provokes Aziz or some third party, their guide for instance, into whatever he does, if anyone does anything. For Adela, the horror of her cave experience and its booming echo ride roughshod over her soul until she recants her testimony against Aziz during the trial. Once the mayhem dies down and she is safely away from the Indians who have hated her and the English who now hate her, she announces that the echo has stopped. What does this suggest? The cave may bring on or point up a variety of inauthentic experience, another existential concept. That is, Adela is confronted by the hypocrisy of her life and her reasons for coming to India or agreeing to marry Ronnie, her fiancé, by her failure to take responsibility for her own existence. Or it may represent a breach of the truth, in a more traditional philosophical tradition, or a confrontation with terror she has denied and can only exorcise by facing them, or something else. For Aziz, too, the caves speak through their aftermath, of the perfidy of the English, of the falseness of his subservience, of his need to assert responsibility for his own life. It may be that Adela does panic in the face of nothingness, only recovering herself when she takes responsibility by recanting in the witness box. Perhaps it's all about nothing more than her own self-doubts, her own psychological or spiritual difficulties. Perhaps it is racial in some way. The only thing we are sure of about the cave as symbol is that it keeps its secrets. That sounds as if I'm punting, but I'm not. What the cave symbolizes will be determined to a large extent by how the individual reader engages the text. Every reader's experience of every work is unique, largely because each person will emphasize various elements to differing degrees, and those differences will cause certain features of the text to become more or less pronounced. We bring an individual history to our reading. A mix of previous readings, to be sure, but also a history that includes but is not limited to educational attainment, gender, race, class, faith, social involvement, and philosophical inclination. These factors will inevitably influence what we understand in our reading, and nowhere is this individuality clearer than in the matter of symbolism. The problem of symbolic meaning is further compounded when we look at a number of writers emphasizing various, distinct elements for a given symbol. As an example, let's consider three rivers. Mark Twain gives us the Mississippi, Hart Crane, the Hudson East Mississippi, / generic American, and T.S. Eliot, the Thames. All three are American writers, all from the Midwest, two from Missouri, no less. Do you suppose there's any chance of their rivers standing for the same thing? In The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, 1885, Twain sends Huck and the escaped slave Jim down the Mississippi on a raft. The river is a little bit of everything in the novel. At the beginning, it floods, killing livestock and people, including Huck's father. Jim is using the river to escape to freedom, but his escape is paradoxical, since it carries him deeper and deeper into slave territory. The river is both danger and safety, since the relative isolation from land and detection is offset by the perils of river travel on a makeshift conveyance. On a personal level, the river/raft provides the platform on which Huck, a white boy, can get to know Jim not as a slave, but as a man. And of course the river is really a road, and the raft trip a quest that results in Huck growing to maturity and understanding. He knows himself well enough at the end that he will never return to childhood and Hannibal and bossy women, so he lights out for the territories. Now, take Hart Crane's poem sequence, The Bridge, 1930, which plays with rivers and bridges throughout. He begins with the East River, spanned by the Brooklyn Bridge. From there, the river grows into the Hudson, and on into the Mississippi, which, for Crane, metonymically represents all American rivers. Interesting things begin happening in the poem. The bridge connects the two pieces of land cut off from one another by the river, while it has the effect of bisecting the stream. The river, meanwhile, does separate the land on a horizontal axis, but connects along a vertical axis, making it possible for people at one end to travel to the other. The Mississippi becomes of central symbolic importance for Crane because of its immense length, bringing the northernmost and southernmost parts of the nation together while making it virtually impossible to move from east to west without some means of traversing the river. His meanings are quite different from those of Twain. Together, the river and the bridge constitute an image of total connection. And Eliot? Eliot uses the River Thames prominently in The Wasteland, written in the immediate aftermath of World War I and of a more personal breakdown. His river carries the detritus of a dying civilization and features, among other things, a rat trailing along the bank. The river is slimy, dirty, its famous bridge falling down, in nursery rhyme form, abandoned by its nymphs. The river is shorn of grandeur, grace, and divinity. In the poem's past, Queen Elizabeth and the Earl of Leicester carry on their dalliance on the water, but their modern counterparts are merely sordid and seedy. Clearly, Eliot's river is symbolic. Equally clearly, it symbolizes things having to do with the corruption of modern life and collapse of Western civilization, which do not come into play with either Twain or Crane. Of course, Eliot's work is heavily ironic, and as we'll discuss later, everything changes when irony climbs aboard. You will have noticed in these last pages that I assert meaning for these uses of caves and symbols with considerable authority, and indeed I have a pretty strong grasp of what they mean for me. The authority I bring to these readings is that of my own background and experience. I incline, for instance, toward a reading of The Wasteland based on its historical context, a historicist reading, if you will, in which the poem cannot be divorced from the recent war and its aftermath. But not everyone comes at the poem from that angle. Others may approach it chiefly in formal terms, or on biographical grounds, as a response to violent personal and marital upheaval. These and many other approaches are not only valid, but produce readings of considerable insight. In fact, I have learned a great deal not only about the poem, but about my own shortcomings from alternative approaches. One of the pleasures of literary scholarship lies in encountering different and even conflicting interpretations, since the great work allows for a considerable range of possible interpretations. Under no circumstances, in other words, should you take my pronouncements on these works as definitive. The other problem with symbols is that many readers expect them to be objects and images rather than events or actions. Action can also be symbolic. Robert Frost is probably the champion of the symbolic action, although his uses of it are so sly that resolutely literal readers can miss the symbolic level entirely. In his poem, Mowing, 1913, for instance, the activity of mowing a field with a scythe, which, mercifully, you and I will never have to do, is first and foremost just what it is, a description of sweeping a field clean of standing hay, one stroke at a time. We also notice, though, that mowing carries weight beyond its immediate context, seeming to stand in for labor generally, or for the solitary business of living one's life, or for something else beyond itself. Similarly, the speaker's account of his recent actions in After Apple Picking, 1914, suggests a point in life as well as a point in the season, and the memory of picking, from the lingering sense of the swaying ladder and the imprint of the rung on his foot soles to the impression of apples on his retinas, suggests the wear and tear of the activity of living on the psyche. Again, the non-symbolic thinker can see this as a beautiful evocation of an autumnal moment, which it is, and pleasurably so. But there is more than just that going on. It may be a little more obvious with the moment of decision in his The Road Not Taken, 1916, which is why it is the universal graduation poem. But symbolic action can also be found in poem after poem, from the terrible accident in Out Out to climbing in Birches, 1916. So, what are you to do? You can't simply say, well, it's a river, so it means X, or apple picking, so it means Y. On the other hand, you can say this could sometimes mean X or Y or even Z, so let's keep that in mind to see which one, if either, happens here. Any past experience of literary rivers or labor may be helpful as well. Then you start breaking down the work at hand into manageable pieces. Associate freely, brainstorm, take notes. Then you can organize your thoughts, grouping them together under headings, rejecting or accepting different ideas or meanings as they seem to apply. Ask questions of the text. What's the writer doing with this image, this object, this act? What possibilities are suggested by the movement of the narrative or the lyric? And most important, what does it feel like it's doing? Reading literature is a highly intellectual activity, but it also involves affect and instinct to a large degree. Much of what we think about literature, we feel first. Having instincts, though, doesn't automatically mean they work at their highest level. Dogs are instinctual swimmers, but not every pup hits the water understanding what to do with that instinct. Reading is like that too. The more you exercise the symbolic imagination, the better and quicker it works. We tend to give writers all the credit, but reading is also an event of the imagination. Our creativity, our inventiveness, encounters that of the writer. And in that meeting, we puzzle out what she means, what we understand her to mean, what uses we can put her writing to. Imagination isn't fantasy. That is to say, we can't simply invent meaning without the writer. Or if we can, we ought not to hold her to it. Rather, a reader's imagination is the act of one creative intelligence engaging another. So, engage that other creative intelligence. Listen to your instincts. Pay attention to what you feel about the text. It probably means something. Chapter 13. It's All Political. Nowadays, we think of A Christmas Carol as a private morality play and a nice Christmas tale to boot. But in 1843, Dickens was actually attacking a widely held political belief, hiding his criticism in the story of a wretched miser who is saved by spiritual visitations. There was a theory afoot at that time, left over from the Puritanism of the previous two centuries, and promulgated most forcefully by the British social thinker Thomas Malthus, that in helping the poor, or in increasing food production to feed more people, we would in fact encourage an increase in the number of the impoverished, who would, among other things, simply procreate faster to take advantage of all that surplus gruel. Dickens caricatures this Malthusian thinking in Scrooge's insistence that he wants nothing to do with the destitute, and if they would rather starve than live in the poorhouse or in debtor's prison, then by golly, they had best hurry up and do it and decrease the excess population. Scrooge actually says that. What a guy. Even if you've never heard of Thomas Malthus, when you read A Christmas Carol or see one of the umpteen versions of it on screen, you can tell something is going on beyond the story. If nasty old Scrooge were one of a kind, just a single, selfish, embittered man, if he were the only man in England who needed to learn this lesson, the tale would not resonate with us as it does. It's not generally in the way of parables, which Carol is, to treat anomalies. No, Dickens picks Scrooge not because he's unique, but because he's representative, because there's something of Scrooge in us and in society. We can have no doubt that the story is meant to change us and through us to change society. Some of Scrooge's pronouncements early in the story are almost verbatim from Malthus or his Victorian descendants. Dickens is a social critic, but he's a sneaky one, remaining so consistently entertaining that we may not notice that a major point of his work is to critique social shortcomings. At the same time, you have to be almost willfully blind to read that story and see only Marley's ghost, three spirits, and Tiny Tim to fail to notice that the tale attacks one way of thinking about our social responsibility and valorizes another. Concerning politics in literary texts, here's what I think. I hate political writing. Novels, plays, poems. They don't travel well, don't age well, and generally aren't much good in their own time and place, however sincere they may be. I speak here of literature whose primary intent is to influence the body politic. For instance, those works of socialist realism, one of the great misnomers of all time, of the Soviet era, in which the plucky hero figures out a way to increase production and thereby meet the goals of the 5-year plan on the collective farm. What I once heard the great Mexican novelist Carlos Fuentes characterize as the love affair between a boy and girl and a tractor. Overtly political writing can be one-dimensional, simplistic, reductionist, preachy, dull. The political writing I personally dislike is programmatic, pushing a single cause or concern or party position, or it's tied into a highly topical situation that doesn't transfer well out of its own specific time and place. Ezra Pound's politics, for instance, a mixture of anti-Semitism and authoritarianism that made Italian fascism congenial to him, are repugnant to any thinking person, and to the extent that they find expression in his poetry, they destroy everything they touch. But even if they weren't so hideous, their use in his verse tends to be clumsy and heavy-handed, too obviously programmatic. When he starts droning on in the cantos about the evils brought about by usura, for instance, eyes glaze over and minds wander. We in the age of credit cards are just not that hopped up about supposed ills of the culture of lending and borrowing between the world wars. The same thing happens with a lot of those left-wing plays of the 1930s. They may have been fine as rallying cries in their day, but as works of lasting interest, they work for lots of us only as cultural anthropology. I love political writing. Writing that engages the realities of its world, that thinks about human problems, including those in the social and political realm, that addresses the rights of persons and the wrongs of those in power, can be not only interesting, but hugely compelling. In this category, we get the grimy London of Dickens' late work, the fabulous postmodern novels of Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Toni Morrison, the plays of Henrik Ibsen and George Bernard Shaw, Seamus Heaney's poetry of the Northern Irish Troubles, and the feminist struggles with a poetic tradition of Evan Boland and Adrienne Rich and Audre Lorde. Nearly all writing is political on some level. D.H. Lawrence's work is profoundly political, even when it doesn't look like it, even when he is less overt than in Women in Love, where he has a character say of a robin that it looks like a little Lloyd George of the air. I'm not quite sure how a robin resembles the then prime minister, but it's clear Lawrence didn't approve, and the character clearly shares her creator's politics. I also know that's not the real political element in that novel. No, his real political contribution is in setting a radical individualism in conflict with established institutions. Lawrence's people keep refusing to behave, to submit to convention, to act in a way that conforms to expectations, even expectations of other nonconformists. In Women in Love, he pillories the bohemianism of the artsy sets of his day, whether the Bloomsbury Circle or the group that Lady Ottoline Morell, the self-consciously bohemian patroness of the arts, gathered around herself. Their avant-gardism merely constitutes another kind of conventionality for him, a way of being chic or in, whereas his heroic ideal goes its solitary way even though it outrage friend as well as foe and confound lover as well as stranger. That radical individualism is politically